The protests forced the cancellation of New York Police Commissioner Ray Kelly's speech. And the New York City Council has approved a measure raising the age for buying cigarettes from 18 to 21. Mayor Michael Bloomberg has pledged to sign the bill. New York is the first major city to take such action, following similar measures in smaller municipalities. The council also approved setting a minimum price of $10.50 a pack for cigarettes. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. Next up is the evening news.
Good people, KBOO 90.7 FM Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Afro-Caribbean All Music Festival. Nine bands will play genres and rhythms all originating from Africa, including Afro Jazz, Calypso, Samba, Salsa, Reggae, and others. The event will feature the bands Jujuba, Love Nasuesa, Super Mokako, Roots Revolution, and others. The festival will be held on November 1st, 2nd, and 3rd at the TAQ Center, 631 Northeast Grand Avenue, Portland, from 7 p.m. until 2:30 a.m. Come dance for three nights straight at the Afro-Caribbean All Music Festival, November 1st, 2nd, and 3rd. More information can be found on the right-hand side of the KABOO.FM website under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KABOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KABOO Evening News, federal cuts to food stamp benefits that go into effect tomorrow will affect thousands of Oregonians.
An officer with the Portland Police Bureau has been appointed as the mayor's public safety policy director.
And a comprehensive report analyzes non-self-defense killings by citizens with concealed carry permits.
Good evening. This is the KABOO Evening News for Thursday, October 31st, 2013. I'm Jen Chavez.
And I'm Sam Bowman. Economic stimulus money that was directed to the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, popularly known as food stamps, expires today. Beginning tomorrow, individuals will receive $11 less in SNAP benefits, and families of four will see their benefits cut by $36 per month. Meanwhile, Democrats and Republicans in Congress are locking horns over this year's farm bill, with future SNAP cuts being the main sticking point. For more on these developments and their implications, KABOO's Genevieve McDaniel spoke with Jeff Clean of the Oregon Food Bank.
I am speaking with Jeff Clean from the Oregon Food Bank. What do the cuts mean for the 47 million Americans affected by the Congressional Farm Bill?
So just to clarify, are you talking about the cuts that take place tomorrow?
The cuts that take place tomorrow.
The cuts that are coming on November 1st really will have a detrimental impact on households that are struggling to have enough to eat. For example, a family of four will lose $36 from their SNAP benefits. And in terms of meals, that's the equivalent of the loss of an entire week's worth of meals for one family member, or it means a family member not being able to eat dinner for 3 weeks out of the month. And unfortunately, we know that SNAP benefits are already inadequate to help most families get through to the end of the month. So the cut that is coming tomorrow will simply mean there is less food on the table of hungry Oregonians.
So what will the ripple effects on the larger economy of making the cuts on SNAP, formerly known as food stamps?
Yeah, the other great aspect of SNAP is not only is it helping families afford enough to eat, it also benefits the economy, and that benefits all of us. Over the next year, because of this cut, Oregon will see a loss of $84 million worth of SNAP benefits. And those are benefits that are spent in grocery stores, at farmers markets, and they help stimulate the economy. And while the economy is getting back on track, for a lot of people, the economy hasn't helped them yet. They're not back on their feet. So the cut in Oregon will have an impact on the state economy, and more largely across the nation over the next year, we'll see the loss of $5 billion worth of SNAP benefits that otherwise could have been helping us get back to an economy that works for everybody.
How is it that SNAP is included in the Congressional Farm Bill?
Well, SNAP as a food program falls under the Farm Bill because the Farm Bill is really all about agriculture and food policy. And food stamps are an important part of the American food system. When there are 47 million Americans who can't afford enough to eat, they need the assistance to have enough food so that they can be healthy and they can succeed in life. So we're talking about children being able to do well in schools, adult being able to find work, do well at work, and ultimately for the companies and organizations that they work for to profit. And that helps all of us, and it strengthens our economy.
Proponents of the bill claim that the proposed cuts to the program will close loopholes which allow people who don't need assistance to secure benefits. Can you speak to this?
What these cuts mean is the loss of real food for real people. The program is there to help out people in times of need, and we have just come through some very difficult economic times, and all of us are fortunate to have a public structure, a public effort like SNAP that is there to prevent hunger and hardship across the country.
I am speaking with Jeff Kleen from the Oregon Food Bank. This is Genevieve McDaniel with KBOO News.
Democratic Congresswoman Susan Bonamici of Oregon visited Tigard's Durham Elementary School today to make the case for reversing cuts to federal education funding that took place under the across-the-board budget sequestration during fiscal year 2013. As a result of budget cuts, Oregon schools lost 5.1% of Title I funding, which provides money for schools with a high number of minority and low-income students. This comes on top of the 20% cuts to Title I that occurred under the No Child Left Behind Act of 2002. Durham Elementary lost $50,000 in federal funding last year due to sequestration, which resulted in some reductions in hours and materials, but left the school's reading program intact. Durham is one of Oregon's top 10 performing schools, despite its high number of minority and low-income students, and school officials attribute that success to Title I funding, which the school spends entirely on reading programs. The school attributes most of its pressing financial woes to Oregon law and funding, rather than federal cuts. Bonamici, however, says, quote, "We can't continue to expect great results if we keep cutting budgets," end quote. Bonamici, along with other lawmakers, is urging the participants in Congress's ongoing budget negotiations to look at defense spending, agricultural subsidies, and the tax code as source for future cuts, rather than education.
Portland Mayor Charlie Hales has announced that a Portland police officer will fill the role of policy liaison between the mayor and the police department. This is the first time that a police officer has served in this position, and the decision has angered police accountability activists in the city. Dan Handelman with Portland Cop Watch spoke with KBOO News about the selection of Officer Dina Wesson-Mitchell to work in the mayor's office as the police liaison.
Baruti Arthari, who had pretty long history as a community activist before he was in the mayor's office fulfilling the same role, resigned a couple of weeks ago, and I had thought there would be a longer search period, that there'd be some more discussions with people in the community about who do you think we should have to fill this role. Maybe there'd be an application process or something, but it sort of just kind of came out on Monday as a surprise, at least to our organization. In terms of the bigger picture, the kind of mistakes that the chief himself, Chief Reese, had been making over the last few years, where he demoted an officer who was a captain and put him in charge of the sex crimes unit when he had been accused of and found guilty of inappropriately touching his subordinates. Chief Reese also has promoted some people who have very unsavory backgrounds. He put his friend, who was a civilian, in a high-up ranking position on the police bureau instead of hiring somebody who was a person of color for that position. This is the same kind of mistake, and the fact that the mayor's now made the same kind of mistake is troubling. I mean, certainly last week when the auditor brought forward what we think are good forward steps in improving our accountability system, but not enough. You know, she didn't go far enough. And then the chief said, well, everything's working fine the way it is, is another indicator of how out of touch he is with the way things really are. As a longtime anti-police brutality activist, Michael Zinzin used to say when he was still with us, you got a rickety old bus, it doesn't really matter that much who the driver is, you got to fix the bus. We have an institution, the police bureau, that's really messed up, and our interest is in making sure that the institution is created in such a way where no matter who's in that driver's seat, we're not going to have these kinds of problems.
That was Dan Handelman of Portland Cop Watch. More information can be found on their website, portlandcopwatch.org.
The Oregon Court of Appeals determined Wednesday that a 12-year-old boy accused of sexually assaulting a 10-year-old girl was coerced into a confession by Portland police officers. The boy, who attends an alternative school due to behavioral issues, was led to a room by his principal, where two plainclothes officers interrogated him for 90 minutes. If the behavior he admitted to had been committed by an adult, he would face charges of second-degree rape. At the initial trial in a Multnomah County juvenile court, defense attorneys asked that the confession be suppressed due to the interview's coercive environment, but the judge denied the request. Yesterday, however, the appeals court found that the detective's behavior did not make it clear to the boy that he was not required to answer and that he was free to leave, even though they did say so at the beginning of the interview. For example, they repeatedly told the boy that it was his responsibility to tell his parents the truth, even as he protested that he was scared to do so and that he had done nothing wrong. Appeals Court Judge James Egan determined that a reasonable 12-year-old boy would have felt coerced by the officer's questions and statements. The case has been sent back to juvenile court. Victims' advocates point out that this type of coercive questioning by officers often ends up helping perpetrators avoid justice.
The Oregon Mediators Association Fall Conference starts Friday in Portland. Mediation is growing in popularity as a less expensive and more civil alternative to court battles. For more on the report, here is KBOO News reporter Genevieve McDaniel in collaboration with Oregon News Service.
People in politics often seem more divided than ever, but a group meeting this weekend in Portland is convinced it doesn't have to be that way. At the Oregon Mediation Association's fall conference, social workers, attorneys, and human resources professionals discuss ways to manage serious conflicts that prompt all sides to collaborate on an outcome without sacrificing their principles. Their keynote speaker, Susan Podziba, has mediated issues for cities, federal agencies, and even the United Nations.
I like to think about mediation as enabling people to solve their own problems, as opposed to having a judge make a decision that may or may not fit the situation in all of its complexity.
Podziba says a good mediator can help people emerge with a solution that none of the parties could have reached on their own. And while mediation often is associated with labor negotiations or divorce and custody battles, it is growing in popularity for neighborhood disputes, foreclosures, and public policy debates. And couldn't Congress use a mediator? Podziba has a different and more helpful take. She points out that many lawmakers are excellent negotiators when they want to be. But recently, one faction tested the limits of its power, and she says when that ran its course, the government shutdown ended.
It's important to note that we had no violence. In many other countries, this deep of a conflict would lead to violence. So we have to be thankful for that and know that our democracy functioned.
There are no specific requirements for becoming a mediator, but Liza McQuaid with the Oregon Mediation Association says there are classes. The group has core standards and guidelines and is working on a certification program. She hopes one day mediation is a first choice for resolving disputes as a less expensive and more practical alternative to filing a lawsuit.
Magic happens when people start really communicating and really trying to get to the bottom of what is the issue and how can we resolve it. And often there are creative ways to resolve it, and when you work together, you can make that happen.
The Oregon Mediation Association Conference is this Friday and Saturday in Portland. This is Genevieve McDaniel with KBOO News.
Voters in Clackamas and Washington counties should be sure to get their ballots in the mail today in order for their vote to be counted in the upcoming November 5th elections. If you don't get your ballot in the mail today, you can still bring it by a drop box by Tuesday, November 5th. Some of the items on the ballot include a bond measure for a pool and community center in West Lynn, which will cost taxpayers a total of $24 million. In Washington County, the city of Cornelius is considering a $2.4 million 20-year bond measure for the construction of a new public library, and voters in the Hillsborough School District will decide on a $25 million bond measure for school construction and maintenance. Ballots can be deposited into a ballot drop box until 8 p.m. on Tuesday, November 5th. Postage is not needed on ballots placed into a drop box. Voters in Washington and Clackamas counties that did not receive a ballot in the mail should contact their local election offices.
While 28 Greenpeace activists plus two journalists remain in a Russian jail for having boarded a Russian offshore oil drilling platform in the Arctic, the Greenpeace flagship Rainbow Warrior has arrived for its first visit ever to Vancouver, Washington. The current Rainbow Warrior has come to the Columbia River to support local efforts to keep coal export terminals out of the Pacific Northwest. Greenpeace's ships have a long history of being on the front lines as well as supporting efforts to protect the environment. They have also been utilized for scientific research, including discovering a new species in the Bering Sea canyons. After last month's action resulting in the unexpected mass arrest, the ship carrying the activists, the Arctic Sunrise, was seized by Russian authorities in international waters. KBOO's Chris Andre talked with Joe Smythe on board the Rainbow Warrior today.
So there's 30 people in prison in Russia right now, 28 Greenpeace activists and two journalists who were on board the Arctic Sunrise when it was involved in a protest against drilling for oil in the Arctic. They were all arrested and have now been in jail for 43 days, mostly in solitary confinement in pretty tough conditions. So we're working across the planet to try and get them free, and we're hoping people can help us free the Arctic 30 because these folks were taking action on behalf of all of us to make sure that oil companies and governments aren't exploiting melting sea ice to drill for more oil, which caused the climate change we're facing in the first place, but rather that it become a global sanctuary that's protected from resource extraction, from oil drilling, because a spill up there would be catastrophic. And even under the best case scenario, it's just getting more fossil fuels out of the ground that's causing more climate change, that's melting the sea ice in the first place. So we think these people, deserve our thanks, and they aren't criminals. And we're working with people all across the planet to make them free.
Beginning with preventing nuclear testing in 1971, Greenpeace vessels have taken on commercial whaling, seal hunts, overfishing, toxic waste dumping, and most recently, offshore oil drilling and other fossil fuel infrastructure. The Rainbow Warrior is docked at Vancouver Landing, which is located west of 100 Columbia Street in Vancouver. It will be open for public tours on Saturday, November 2nd, and Sunday, November 3rd, from 10 a.m. until 5 p.m.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an interview by KBOO reporter Paul Rowland with longtime anti-nuclear activist Harvey Wasserman about the ongoing nuclear crisis in Fukushima. Following at 6 will be Wisdom of the Elders, featuring culture, music, wisdom, and more from Native American elders. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news, views, and hip-hop. Tomorrow's weather will be partly sunny with some patchy morning fog and a high near 60 degrees. Tomorrow night will be rainy with lows dropping to around 46 degrees. And in today's Radcast, the only citizen-led radiation count on the air, radiation levels for today are 38 counts per minute in North Portland with a high of 59. In Beaverton, it's 37 CPM with a high of 52. Damascus, Oregon has a count of 32 CPM with a high of 49. Pell Butte measures 26 CPM with a high of 40. Seaside, Oregon has 38 CPM with a high of 48. Hanford, Washington has 28 CPM with a high of 40. And Sitka, Alaska has a radiation count of 37 counts per minute with spikes up to 62. EPA alert levels start at 100 CPM. More information can be found at radcast.org.
It's Thursday, October 31st, Halloween, and time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
It was my privilege to go to Des Moines, Iowa recently for a World Food Prize extravaganza recognizing Monsanto's work against global hunger. But wait, Monsanto's not a hunger fighter. It's a predatory proliferator of proprietary GMO seeds. That's why I wasn't actually attending the ceremony to bestow a false halo on the corporate giant. Rather, I was one of more than 500 scruffy outsiders in the First United Methodist Church to protest the Monsanto absurdity. There, real-life Iowa farmers spoke plainly about the myriad of abuses they have endured at the hands of the genetic manipulator. One pointed out that if the corporation genuinely gave even one damn about hunger, it could have used its immense lobbying clout in Washington this year to stop Congress from stripping the entire food stamp program from the Farm Bill. Instead, Monsanto didn't lift a finger to help fend off hunger in our own country. It doesn't care at all about feeding the world, he said with disgust. It cares about profits, period. Indeed, Monsanto is a pitch-perfect example of what Pope Francis was referring to in May when he declared, "Widespread corruption and selfish fiscal evasion have taken on worldwide dimensions. The will to power and of possession has become limitless. Concealed behind this attitude is a rejection of ethics." How ironic, then, that Monsanto bought this food prize for itself in order to masquerade as a world hunger fighter, hoping to persuade the Vatican to bless its demonic effort to force the world's poor farmers to buy and become dependent on its altered seed. This is Jim Hightower saying, the World Food Prize Foundation says it recognizes contributions for agriculture. But Monsanto has zero to do with agriculture. It is the agribusiness face of the unethical corruption that Francis warned about.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
A newly updated comprehensive report compiled by the Violence Policy Center analyzes non-self-defense killings committed by citizens with permits to carry concealed handguns. The online database, called Concealed Carry Killers, catalogs nearly 400 incidents that have occurred since mid-2007, resulting in at least 540 deaths. The database, which the Violence Policy Center points out likely represents only a fraction of such incidents, contains telling data about incidents such as mass shootings, murder-suicides, and killings of law enforcement officers. Today, I spoke with the Violence Policy Center's legislative director, Kristen Rand, for more details on the report.
First of all, how did your center compile the data used in the Concealed Carry Killers report?
We compile the data by combing through news reports and some state reports on crimes committed by concealed carry permit holders, although the vast majority of it is from news reports because that's really the only source available for information in most states.
What would you say are some of the most egregious examples of non-self-defense shootings listed in your database? For example, could you speak on the prevalence of permits for concealed handguns in mass shootings?
Yes, we found that concealed carry permit holders have committed at least 26 mass shootings in the last 6 years. We find that really ironic given the fact that one of the main reasons put forward for passing lax concealed carry laws was to prevent mass shootings. We have found no evidence of any mass shooting that's ever been prevented by a concealed carry permit holder, but we found 26 that have been committed by them in the last 6 years.
What's the progress on prosecution of some of the folks whose incidents are listed in your database?
As to outcome, we found that 135 of the killers have been convicted. A lot of the incidents in our study are suicides, either suicides by an individual or suicides in the context of a murder-suicide. And then we found that 58 of the cases are still pending, with 48 of those charged with criminal homicide.
And what issues, if any, do you think that your report's finding raise about the screening processes used to grant citizens concealed carry permits?
Well, the screening processes are inadequate by definition, because what we find is that probably in the majority of the incidents that we have identified where a concealed carry permit holder kills an innocent person, many of those people have no criminal history. And what happens is what we feared at the outset when states started passing these laws, that the presence of a gun escalates an ordinary argument to a homicide. And that's what we've seen. Cases of road rage, cases where neighbors get into arguments, domestic disputes. Those people don't necessarily have a criminal background where they would be screened out. They just have a gun handy when they're angry. But we also have seen many cases where people do have significant criminal histories or mental problems and still succeed in getting a concealed carry permit. We think that states should really reevaluate the value of these systems as a whole, that the theory is to put guns in the hands of good guys to prevent crime and stop the bad guys. We see no evidence that that's the effect of these.
Could you speak a little bit more on what legislative changes you at the Violence Policy Center would like to see prompted by the information in your report?
Well, what we definitely see is that states that allow law enforcement more discretion in who to issue permits to have a better record, that we really see a lot of incidents like Florida. Florida was the state that pioneered these so-called shall issue laws, where law enforcement has no discretion whatsoever as to who to issue a permit to. Once you meet a set of objective criteria, you are eligible for the permit, period. And that in those kinds of systems, a lot of really dangerous people get through the cracks. Where you have local law enforcement with the discretion to issue the permit, either based on a person's record or just the gut feeling of law enforcement, that they're familiar with someone in their community, they know that person shouldn't have access to a firearm, shouldn't be licensed to have a firearm, that builds in a break to stop some of these really dangerous people from getting concealed carry permits.
I've been speaking with Kristen Rand, the legislative director of the Violence Policy Center. This has been Jen Chavez for KBOO News.
In Virginia, a wrongful death charge against the state in relation to the notorious 2007 mass shooting at Virginia Tech was overturned by the state Supreme Court. With 32 students and faculty killed by the gunman, Seung-Hui Cho, in two separate incidents hours apart, the Virginia Tech shooting was the worst school shooting in American history. The parents of two students who died in the shooting filed a negligence suit against the state because the university didn't warn the rest of the campus following the first incident, in which two students were shot in a campus dorm. The gunman remained at large and 2 hours later shot many more students and faculty at the campus Norris Hall before committing suicide. The 2012 county jury ruled in favor of the plaintiffs. The jury's original award to those two families of $4 million each was later reduced to $100,000 each by a judge. The state has said that security officials on campus believe the dorm shooting to be an isolated dispute and therefore didn't find it necessary to warn the rest of the campus. The justices of the Virginia's Supreme Court ruled today that the state was not obligated to warn others on campus because risk of second incident was not, quote, known or reasonably foreseeable.
In Sanford, Florida, the site of the 2012 shooting of unarmed teenager Trayvon Martin by Neighborhood Watch member George Zimmerman, civilian neighborhood patrols won't be permitted to carry guns anymore. This is in accordance with new rules that the police department plans to announce next week. Reason for the rule changes include reviving the program's reputation, according to Shannon Cordingley, a spokesperson for the Sanford Police Department, who described people in the community as nervous to join a group so tarnished by the media. The changes reflect part of a major restructuring of the entire department, being steered by new police chief Cecil Smith, who took over after his predecessor was fired in the wake of the Zimmerman investigation. The new rules also call for establishing a new community relations unit to oversee the program, which for the first time will include more precise tracking of watch groups.
The Affordable Care Act has been attacked by the right for a number of reasons, most of which are not based in fact. But analyst Kevin Zeese argues that the left has been too quick to defend the law, which he says is actually a huge giveaway to an already bloated private insurance industry. Instead, he advocates a, quote, Medicare for All system, also known as single payer. He is the co-author of an article released today on truthout.org, which criticizes Obamacare for expanding the existing market-based healthcare system. The article points to a 2013 report by the Institute of Medicine, which found that Americans live shorter lives and experience more injuries and illnesses than people in other high-income countries. The U.S. health disadvantage cannot be attributed solely to the adverse health status of racial or ethnic minorities or poor people. Even highly advantaged Americans are in worse health than their counterparts in similar countries. For more, KBOO's Jenka Soderberg spoke with Kevin Zeese.
What do you see as some of the main problems with it?
I think the major problems with it are that it provides for very poor health care. The insurance coverage provided doesn't cover as much as they claim. There are four levels of plans. The two that are most commonly going to be sold are going to be silver and bronze. What those plans do is they leave you, the consumer, with 30% or 40%, depending on which plan you get, from the cost of health care. So if you get ill and have an expensive operation or need expensive pharmaceuticals or need to stay in the hospital, the consumer pays 30% of that cost. And making that even worse is what the insurance companies are doing is they're shrinking their networks of coverage. So they'll cover less doctors and less hospitals. And any out-of-network cost, you pay the whole thing. So this is a scam. And to sell this scam, they've created a nonprofit called Enroll America, which is made up of the same advocacy groups that pushed Obamacare, plus the insurance industry, plus the pharmaceutical industry, and the for-profit hospitals, all led by a former White House official who's the executive director. And they can spend $100 million using Madison Avenue techniques to sell this crummy insurance to people. And so you think you're getting something, but you're not. And everything that they try to sell you with, for example, pre-existing illnesses will be covered is a very popular one. That sounds great. Pre-existing illnesses should be covered. But the reality is that under the details of the plan, there are lots of ways for the corporation, the insurance company, to avoid paying anything to pre-existing illness. First, if your age can affect the cost of the premium by three times the amount. So if you're a little bit older, what most pre-existing illnesses are, you'll be paying three times the premium, and that makes it almost unaffordable. So you can get it, you just can't afford it.
Is it the influence of the insurance companies and the pharmaceutical industry that created this watered-down version of what was initially a well-intended act?
No, this was never a well-intended act. The first time this was discussed, before it even went to Congress, they had a White House health summit. And at that summit, the insurance industry spoke first, the insurance industry spoke last. And excluded from the summit were single-payer activists. Most Americans want a single-payer Medicare for all system. But they weren't even allowed to come until there were threats of protest, and when they got there, they weren't allowed to talk. You know, it's very hard to talk about this with Democrats because the Republican attacks are so crazy. I mean, they are just made-up nonsense. Death panels and socialized medicine. Such, you know, just
totally false stuff. And so it naturally creates a situation where people who are Democrat partisans will defend the president, defend the ACA, because the lies are so obvious by the Republicans. And so while they're busy defending against the Republicans, they're now looking at the reality, which is this is not what we wanted. The American people by over 60% want a single-payer Medicare for all system. And 80% of Democrats want that kind of a system. We didn't get that, and we didn't go in that direction. We went the opposite direction. This is not a step towards single-payer. It's a step away from single-payer because it entrenches the insurance industry further. We'll be spending tax dollars on paying for premiums rather than on paying for health care. But there have been polls that have been done for more than 10 years now, consistently showing 60%+ of Americans support a single-payer system. And, you know, they keep that out of the debate. They don't want anyone to hear that. But that's what polls have showed consistently for 10 years. Two-thirds of doctors also support it. Majority of nurses also support it. This is what Americans wanted. And it was not even allowed to be discussed by Obama or by the Senate Finance Committee Chair, Max Baucus, who really wrote the bill, or actually had a staffer who was a former executive for a health insurance industry. She actually wrote the bill. And after she finished doing her damage in the Congress, Obama hired her to work in HHS to implement the bill and help write the regulations where she did more damage. Now she's out of the government and working back again, not for the insurance industry this time where she came from, but for Big Pharma, working on lobbying for international laws for pharmaceuticals. So that's who wrote the bill. Obama hired her after Baucus hired her, and before that she worked in the insurance industry. And so we got an insurance protection bill. We didn't get a health care bill that really helps most Americans. This was a Republican law. The conflict we see in Congress is a charade just to keep us actually seeing the truth. And the truth is we need to get rid of the insurance industry, get control of the pharmaceutical industry, and end the for-profit hospitals. Then we can start, and we can do all that under a single-payer system. And that's what we need to focus on is the real solution, not the fraudulent solution of the Affordable Care Act, which is not affordable and does not provide the care to all Americans.
I've been speaking with Kevin Zeese. He's the co-author with Margaret Flowers of Obamacare, the Biggest Insurance Scam in History, that can be found on truthout.org. This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
Lawmakers at the state level are working to pass laws which cut wages, reduce benefits, and limit bargaining power of both union and non-union workers, which, according to a newly released study generated by the Economic Policy Institute, come at the behest of corporate lobbies. In this first-ever comprehensive examination of such legislative efforts, EPI's report argues that the nation's most powerful corporate interests are systematically undermining workers' abilities to earn a middle-class wage. They say this tilts the labor market even further in the interest of the economic elite by stripping away protections already in place. The report's author, Gordon Lafer, who is an associate professor with the University of Oregon, argues that local politics have become nationalized as the language in state legislation is being drafted by lobbyists working for national and multinational corporations. These anti-union campaigns get funded primarily through trade association groups like the Chamber of Commerce and National Association of Manufacturers, along with more ideological groups like the Club for Growth and Americans for Prosperity, which is backed by the Koch brothers. Another group playing a significant role in the trend is the American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC, which acts as matchmaker, facilitating relations between corporations and lawmakers. 31 bills introduced in Oregon during the 2013 legislative session involved changing laws in the areas of labor rights and practices.
A report released yesterday offers new evidence of water contamination caused by hydraulic fracturing. The report was authored by affiliates of San Jose University and the environmental consulting firm Downstream Strategies in collaboration with the nonprofit organization Earthworks. The report's findings reveal that fracking poses threats to water resources, especially in water-poor regions. According to the report, over 90% of water injected into underground fracking wells never returns to the surface, removing it permanently from the water cycle. Over 80% of water used in West Virginia fracking comes from rivers, very little of which is ever recycled. The report shows that as the fracking industry expands, the volume of waste is also mounting, Between 2010 and 2011, Pennsylvania's fracking-related water waste increased by over 70%, totaling 610 million gallons. The report emphasizes that, despite efforts in a number of states to gather information on fracking-related water use and waste, reporting remains incomplete. Researchers add that, due to missing data, nobody knows the full impact of hydraulic fracturing on water resources. President Obama has promoted natural gas as an alternative to fossil fuels, but critics say that his energy plan fails to address the problems caused by the extraction of natural gas using processes like hydraulic fracturing.
NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden may be moving to Germany, according to a new report. Human rights attorneys have reported that Snowden, currently in Russia, may have an asylum offer coming from Germany. The announcement follows the revelation last week that the NSA spied on German President Angela Merkel, a revelation that strained U.S.-German relations. The news about Snowden's asylum offer in Germany has not yet been made public, but was leaked on Twitter by the Government Accountability Project. Up to this point, only Nicaragua, Venezuela, and Bolivia, in addition to Russia, have expressed willingness to give Edward Snowden asylum.
In the latest news from U.S.-occupied Afghanistan, a clash between Afghan soldiers and Taliban fighters early this morning in the capital city of Saripul province killed five and injured a dozen more. Three soldiers and two Taliban insurgents were killed when the insurgents ambushed the soldiers' convoy, prompting an hours-long firefight. One of the 12 injured was a civilian.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Thursday, October 31st, 2013. Israeli troops kill a Palestinian man and kidnap 13 others during invasions targeting a number of Hispanic communities. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Israeli soldiers killed on Thursday at dawn a Palestinian young man and kidnapped four others during an invasion targeting Kabatia town near the northern West Bank city of Jenin. Local sources announced that Ahmed Imad Tazaza, 22, was shot by a live round in the heart during clashes with the invading soldiers. Furthermore, soldiers broke into and violently searched dozens of homes, causing property damage, and kidnapped four Palestinians. Elsewhere, dozens of soldiers and police officers invaded Al-Isawiyah town in occupied East Jerusalem and kidnapped seven Palestinian youths. Local sources have reported that the soldiers and police officers invaded Al-Isawiyah before violently breaking into and searching dozens of homes, causing excessive property damage and kidnapping seven young Palestinians. In Bethlehem City, southern West Bank, soldiers searched and ransacked homes in the city center and the nearby Dehesh refugee camp before kidnapping two men. Local sources in the camp have reported that dozens of youth hurled stones at the invading soldiers who fired rubber-coated metal bullets and gas bombs. No injuries were reported. In related news, dozens of soldiers installed roadblock at the entrance of Idna town, west of the southern West Bank city of Hebron, prevented the Palestinian farmers from entering their lands and distributed leaflets ordering the residents not to enter their lands adjacent to the annexation wall. Soldiers also installed roadblocks at the main entrance of Beni Noaim town, east of Hebron, the Al-Fuwar refugee camp south of the city, and Halhul Bridge north of Hebron. Troops stopped and searched dozens of vehicles and inspected ID cards of residents. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Thursday, October 31st, 2013 News Roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Bannoura.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Nell Gagnon, Genevieve McDaniel, Robin Ryan, Sam Bowman, and Nastasia Voisin. The producer is Jen Chavez. Our engineer is Matthew Olson. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath, 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River, 91.5 FM. I'm Sam Bowman.
And I'm Jen Chavez. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, it's Positively Revolting Talk Radio with an eco-feminist and anarcho-feminist perspective. Guest host Paul Rowland speaks with Larry Bensky, longtime KPFA and Pacifica radio program host who retired in 2007 after several decades with KPFA, the first Pacifica station which pioneered listener-sponsored radio. At 9, it's APA Compass, a forum for dialogue, exploration, and dissemination of issues pertinent to Asian and Pacific Islander communities. At 10, hear Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, it's Shahid Hamid hosting It Takes a Village, a program focusing on the African-American community here in Portland. Thank you, KBOO members, for supporting the station during our recent fundraising drive. If you missed it, you can still donate online at kboo.fm. And stay tuned now for an interview by KBOO's Paul Rowland with longtime anti-nuclear activist Harvey Wasserman about the ongoing crisis in Fukushima. Good night, Sam.
Good night, Jen.
Good night, Matt. Good night, Matt.
Good night.
And I am Paul Rowland, and thank you so much to the KBOO News team. Isn't that a great broadcast? Really appreciate that. And I do have Harvey Wasserman on the line from, I believe, Ohio. Are you there, Harvey?
Yeah.
Good day. So I'm going to forego this introduction I wrote because we don't have a whole lot of time, but needless to say, you've had, over 30 years of experience in this anti-nuclear organizing, starting way back in 1973, or at least I read on Wikipedia. I guess that's true.
It is true. It's actually 40 years, but who's counting?
40, actually, that's true, 40 years. So let's just jump right into it. We're not really going to have a lot of time to get into all the details of the current mess there with the radioactive water leaking in the Pacific, the melted cores, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I've been talking to people. It's such a disheartening and really disempowering situation. And I feel like people are having a difficult time even thinking about this, kind of coming to grips with the dimensions in immensity of this. And I almost get the feeling that people who are supposedly delegated to deal with and manage this might be having these same problems. And I know that you've kind of jumped into the breach to try to bring some appeals to some kind of coordinated global action, since apparently TEPCO, the Japanese company, and the Japanese government are not really confronting this crisis. So I'd kind of like to focus on that, as it were. And so I'd like to ask you, just basically talk about the management of the crisis, how the Japanese government has been dealing or not dealing with it, their relationship to TEPCO, the electric company, and what you think needs to be done.
Well, the Japanese government is dealing with it by clamping down on information coming out of the site. What we know for sure is that there's 1,331 highly radioactive fuel rods stuck in the air, 100 feet in the air, at Fukushima Unit 4. They have to come down. And the company TEPCO is starting to do that next week. But they are completely incompetent, dishonest, and can't be trusted. It's a for-profit company undertaking a an engineering test that has never been done, on which the fate of the Earth really rests. And it's a very, very serious situation. We're starting to get some press coverage of it just by continuing to bang away at these guys. But if one of those, God forbid, one of those fuel rods falls or breaks, or otherwise has a serious problem, the radiation releases could be apocalyptic. They could be bad enough to force people to leave the site and to interfere with electronic equipment there. This operation is going to be going on for more than a year, and we want the public to be, the media, the public to be focused on this. The banner I'm bringing to the UN on a week from today, over 100,000 signatures, a move-on petition that you can access from nukefree.org, N-U-K-E-F-R-E-E.org. Please go there, click on the link, and sign the petition asking for a global takeover at the Fukushima site, because we cannot trust TEPCO or the Japanese government, really, to do this job right. We don't know if it can be done right. The fuel rods are probably damaged, bent, corroded, and brittled. The assemblies themselves are in questionable shape. There was salt water poured in, and we're never going to get the truth from the utility or the Japanese government. So this is going to require serious vigilance for the upcoming year. And so we also have three melted cores from reactors. It's almost mind-bending to say that, but there are three units 1, 2, and 3 melted and exploded at Fukushima. We don't know where the cores of the reactors are, and people have to go in there, and they're telling us now that they're not going to start looking for those cores, really, to dig them out until 2020. And this is, you know, some of the glories of nuclear power. You and Oregon were smart enough to shut the Trojan nuclear plant, and obviously globally we have to transition to a solar-topian economy, solar, wind, tidal, geothermal, as soon as possible. But meanwhile, these reactor sites continue to plague us, and we're going to have to watch with bated breath as the world copes with what's happened in Fukushima.
So this is obviously an absolutely unprecedented situation, which is why we're having a hard time getting our minds around it, as you're saying. And our global institutions are... obviously have proven very incapable of dealing with much minor crisis situations. Where do you see this? You talk about a global takeover. Given that this is an unprecedented situation and we're not very good at dealing with unprecedented situations to begin with, where do you see this playing out potentially? Where would this, what sort of global coalition could possibly come together?
Well, we're hoping that the public will, and the global community will realize how serious the situation this is and find a way. I mean, I'm told that, we have to respect Japanese sovereignty, and I've been in Japan. I was there in the mid-70s. I actually wrote about Fukushima. People were saying, hey, listen, maybe you shouldn't build nuclear reactors in earthquake tsunami zones. And the government and the utility said, no, 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 and they scoffed at us. And said, we can handle it. There won't be a storm. And of course, it happened. And now they're saying, well, no, we can handle this. They can't handle it. We have to have the world's best scientists and engineers available to make sure that this fuel situation is dealt with, fuel rods, that the cores are found, that the water, there's massive quantities of water pouring through the Fukushima site, becoming heavily contaminated and pouring into the Pacific Ocean. We hear people on the pro-nuclear, the industry people saying, oh, it's not going to hurt you. The radiation will diffuse itself and blah, blah, blah. But this is an apocalyptic situation. The government has a major stake in covering this up because they have the Olympics coming. They don't want their own people knowing what's going on there. And their response, of course, as so often happens to bad news, is that the government is going to clamp down on the news and not on the reality. And we have to really pay attention here. The ideal situation in this worst of all situations would be to have a global coalition with the necessary funding to go in there and do whatever is possible to be done. The Japanese, this administration in Japan is very right-wing, very militaristic, very pro-nuclear, and it's going to be a very difficult dynamic, and it's going to go on for years. I mean, I don't believe that they're going to be able to bring those fuel rods down in a year. This thing, usually when fuel rods are brought down from a spent fuel pool, it's done in a computerized fashion. But in this case, the cranes have to be operated manually because of the damage done to the pool, to the assemblies, to the rods themselves. And, people are going to have to be watching this very, very closely, and we hope that at least we can get some information out before the Japanese clamp down entirely.
Okay. Now, given that, I just noticed that the Energy Secretary, Ernest Monizzi, was in Japan and said, we expect he preferred aid to the struggling effort to clean up and decommission Fukushima's crippled nuclear plant, and said that we need to expand and deepen our relationship in the area of decommissioning in the coming years. It seems like the response is just so absolutely mind-bendingly inadequate to the reality of the situation. So given that the national governments are in denial, not dealing with this, they've got their pride or whatever's going on, their interests, have you gotten feedback from engineers and scientists on this issue?
Yeah, there's one great engineer named Arnie Gunderson, who was in the industry for many, many years. He's based in Vermont. His website is Fairwinds, Fairewinds, Fairwinds. And he's been posting the best information we've been getting, in some cases the only information we've been getting about what's going on at the Fukushima site, for quite a while now. And he's been essential to the whole play out of this situation. And, if you want to be informed on the technical side, look at his stuff. But, we're still dependent on TEPCO and the Japanese for the flow of information as this decommissioning proceeds. The New York Times ran a piece today about the new State Secrets Act that's being pushed in Japan, and saying it was a bad thing, and didn't even mention Fukushima. I mean, the whole reason for this clampdown on information coming out of Japan is because of Fukushima. And the Times somehow didn't think it was worthy to mention that aspect, but it's a very, very frightening situation.
So we only have a minute or so left. I just want to, do you think this United Nations angle is a good angle? Have you gotten feedback from the United Nations yet?
No. And, the United Nations Agency on Nuclear, the IAEA, International Atomic Energy Agency, is very much a captive of the nuclear industry. But we don't know where else to go. I mean, the best place we could think of was the General Assembly of the United Nations. But we haven't gotten a response yet. We're just going to have to keep pushing.
Are there any countries in the world that are taking any kind of lead on this?
No, they are not. China has expressed concern. They're right around the corner, of course, right downwind, they're technically upwind, but the wind does shift. And, we're a long way from getting an answer here. But the fact is that the physical situation of Fukushima is terrifying. You can follow it at nukefree.org, which I edit, nukefree.org. I keep posting links to articles every day. There's a terrible labor situation there. I mean, it's an endless disaster, and people, especially on the West Coast, really need to focus on what's happening in Fukushima, and we just have to figure out how to get the global attention there so that the resources can go there, and we're not left in the tender mercies of TEPCO and the Japanese government.
Well, the aliens aren't going to come in and save us, that's for sure.
Well, we'll have to save ourselves. You're right, and we have to do that. We have to know what's going on, and that's going to be just to know what's going on there is a struggle. And so, you know, NukeFree.org and Fairwinds, those are the two websites that have been covering this. And, you know, sign a petition and keep your eyes on this because and Ron Wyden, actually, the senator from Oregon, has expressed some interest in this. He's the only member of Congress so far that has gone out of his way to make statements about Fukushima. So people might want to call his office and get him further fired up on this.
Okay, well, thank you. Thank you, Harvey. Unfortunately, we got to go. We got another program coming up. I really appreciate talking to you, Harvey Wasserman, longtime nuclear activist. And this has been Paul Rowan with the KBOO News.
You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to help co-sponsor the Visegrad Group PDX Festival, November 9th from 1 p.m. to 7 p.m. at the Polish Hall, 3832 North Interstate Avenue in Portland. To celebrate the 95th anniversary of independence of the Czech, Polish, and Hungarian nations, this one-day festival will share traditions, history, arts and crafts, and national food of the Czech, Polish, and Hungarian communities within Multnomah County. Again, the Visegrad Group PDX Festival will take place at the Polish Hall, 3832 North Interstate Avenue, on Saturday, November 9th, from 1 to 7 p.m. More information about this KBOO-sponsored event may be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO is proud to co-sponsor the Vagabond Opera's 7th Annual Day of the Dead Bash, the Transylvanian Voodoo Ball. This concert and Day of the Dead celebration honoring the ancestors is coming up on November 1st, 8 p.m. at the Star Theater, 13 Northwest 6th Avenue in Portland. The neo-gypsy cabaret Vagabond Opera and the Russian gypsy punk band Shervona will play, along with many special